Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll first go to New Delhi, India, and speak with Dr. Sumit Ganguly, the Chair of Indian Cultures and Civilizations at Indiana University, and discuss the apparent political paralysis in India, where the politicians in charge do not seem to have any idea of what went wrong and why, when hundreds of millions of citizens lost power for days. Then we will speak with Miriam Golden, the Vice Chair of Graduate Studies in the Department of Political Science at UCLA. She is just back from India, where she has been studying the power grid in India's largest state and was there during the blackouts. Then we'll look into the Tea Party victory in Texas, where an ex-CIA officer and extremely conservative Republican lieutenant governor running for the United States Senate was defeated by a conservative extremist who was promoted by Sarah Palin, Glenn Beck, and Sean Hannity, and lavishly supported with outside money from Grover Norquist, Dick Armey, and the Koch brothers. Matt Engel, who directs the Texas Democratic Trust and the Lone Star Project, joins us to discuss whether the further purging of the GOP establishment gives Democrats an opening with rejected refugees from the Republican Party. Then finally, we will pay tribute to Gore Vidal, who passed away yesterday in Los Angeles at the age of 86. Over the decades, the Pacifica Archives have captured Gore Vidal's acerbic critiques of the life and times of the American Republic as it struggles to survive the American Empire. And we will play some excerpts of his speeches and interviews. Joining us now from New Delhi is Dr. Sumit Ganguly, who holds the Rabindranath Tagore Chair of Indian Cultures and Civilizations at Indiana University in Bloomington. He is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations in New York and the International Institute of Strategic Studies in London. His books include Fearful Symmetry, India and Pakistan Under the Shadow of Nuclear Weapons, and India Since 1980. And his latest book, just out, co-author with Espal Kapoor, is India, Pakistan and the Bomb, Debating Nuclear Stability in South Asia, Contemporary Asia and in the World. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Sumit Ganguly.
Thank you.
So you're in New Delhi. You've had 2 days of power outages, obviously not as bad as in the rest of the country, particularly in the north and the east. What's happening today? Was there power today in New Delhi?
In vast sections of New Delhi, power has been restored and life is resuming a sense of normalcy, though there is an enormous sense of anger and frustration amongst the citizenry, a sense that they have been seriously let down. And this happened at a time when the weather was had been pretty miserable, and only the last few days, fortunately, when actually the power did go out, there had been a little bit of a respite because of the rains. But there is a widespread sense of anger and frustration with what has transpired.
So does this call into question India's superpower ambitions? In other words, often India and China are considered the rising powers in the world, but the vision of India as a superpower in the future has taken a pretty bad hit, hasn't it?
It has certainly taken a very bad hit, but one has to bear in mind that unlike in China, where various matters, perhaps not of this magnitude, but various matters can actually be hushed up, they cannot be hushed up in India. In India, everything is available for people to examine and scrutinize, warts and all. And obviously, in the days and weeks ahead, this issue will be front and center in Indian political debates and available for the entire world to read. But yes, at one level it does, I'm afraid, cast aspersions about India's imminent rise as a great power.
Well, in the midst of this power outage, the Minister for Power was essentially promoted to Home Minister. Now, that's pretty extraordinary, and I take it the kind of vigorous press in India must be all over that story.
They have been acerbic in their criticisms of what has transpired, and it also reveals the lack of the depth of the bench in the Congress Party, that there just is such a paucity of people that they could probably turn to, that they fell back on a sort of a member of the cabinet who had clearly demonstrated that he's utterly inept. And even though what appalled me no end was that in an interview with a major Indian national television channel, he actually had the temerity to say, "I've done an excellent job as the power minister." I mean, it's as if the man is impervious to what's going on around him.
So what is the explanation then for the Congress Party, which has been in power for most of India's democracy, and of course essentially one family, the Gandhi family, have dominated, and now the widow, who's not even Indian, is a powerful figure apparently. Is this just a case of what happens with entrenched parties like the PRI in Mexico after 70 years finally collapsed through its own kind of corruption? The Liberal Democratic Party in Japan has the same similar problem. What is the explanation for what you're considering the ineptitude of the party and its lack of depth in terms of its bench of politicians?
There's little question that the party has been entrenched in Indian politics for a very long time, and as a consequence, there's a certain sclerosis in the political party. But beyond that, one shouldn't simply blame Congress. One also has to take into account the propensity of other politicians who have engaged in similar populist practices as providing cheap or virtually free power to farmers and other agricultural constituencies, and have simply ignored hard budget constraints and have simply raided the exchequer as needed. And also the failure of regulatory mechanisms in India, which should have much greater teeth, and the rampant political interference in state electricity boards, which are responsible for the transmission of power, where bureaucrats come under considerable pressure from politicians, regardless of ideological persuasion. And unfortunately, the whole discussion about what might be done is simply calls for greater state involvement. That instead of saying that, look, the state's involvement in the generation and distribution of power has been abysmal, it's time to privatize power. But instead of suggesting that, the suggestion is, well, all we need is better regulation, greater sort of scrutiny, greater surveillance. All of those things might be ameliorative. But the fundamental problem remains that unless power is priced at a level where it generates enough revenue, you will never be able to invest in new plant and equipment. You will not be able to modernize your transmission capabilities, and you will not also be able to deal with the problem of theft. A private power company will take theft much more seriously because they are beholden to stockholders. And I'm afraid similar kinds of controls don't exist on public power companies, and hence there is a profligate theft of power in India.
So what about India's emerging business community? And we hear all about the high-tech boom in India and the call centers proliferating, etc. Obviously, they all operate on power. I know most people, and I assume big businesses, have backup generators. But you would think that the business community would be weighing in, because according to the government's own study, the power failures cost India's growth rate about 1.2% a year.
You know, basically, what a lot of industries have done have set up what are referred to as captive power plants, which are power plants which are solely dedicated to meeting their own needs, because they simply cannot afford to be reliant upon the grid. But this form of opting out has perverse consequences, because then the operators of the grid feel, well, why should we work up a sweat? These people are off the grid anyway. It's of no great consequence to us if we don't supply them with steady, uninterrupted, reliable power. And this is a real tragedy, but basically what a lot of businesses have discovered, small and large, is that because they cannot rely on the grid, they have either generators if they are small businesses or have captive power plants if they are more significant, larger-sized businesses. And as a result, the incentive to respond to their needs has declined even further. And it thereby you create a rather vicious spiral.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Sumit Ganguly in New Delhi. Apparently, India is making an effort to build more generating plants, but I believe a lot of them are coal-fired, which, of course, will add to global warming. What's the state of the green movement in India? Because I saw a map a while back that showed India at the turn of the century and then through the 20s, 30s, 40s up to the present in terms of how much of the country was covered by forests. And it's a shocking deforestation. It's quite amazing.
It is. And that comes after significant reforestation and afforestation efforts, which in part actually have been successful. So imagine if those efforts had not been underway and if they hadn't met with a modicum of success. Things would be even more dire than the map that you saw. So yes, indeed, coal-fired plants do contribute to the hydrocarbons in the atmosphere. But given that India has substantial deposits of coal, there has been a propensity to open up further coal-fired plants.
Well, what about green energy, though? We've talked about coal-powered plants being built to make up for the deficiency in the demand, and we haven't talked about how to fix the grid. It sounds like that's a monstrous problem in itself. And nuclear power, but no wind, no solar, that's not in the menu?
No, that's not true. There are certain Indian firms that actually are at the forefront of wind energy. There's a firm called Suzlon, S-U-Z-L-O-N, which has not only created wind farms in this country, but has also tried to sell the technology abroad. So there are incipient efforts underway. Solar energy is actually quite plentiful in this country, but its potential really has not been tapped. In part, it has to do with the costs of solar cells and solar collectors. There's an initial gestation cost. And also, I think there is a tendency to emulate other states that, you know, if solar energy is so terribly attractive, why haven't the advanced industrial states made greater investments there? I think there's a certain kind of emulative tendencies that exist. And unless there's a kind of a proven success of solar energy elsewhere, there's a certain hesitation on the part of Indian policymakers to go down that route, even though more thoughtful advocates in Indian civil society have been pushing for a more aggressive approach to solar energy.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today from New Delhi, Dr. Sumit Ganguly.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Sumit Ganguly, who holds the Rabindranath Tagore Chair of Indian Cultures and Civilizations at Indiana University in Bloomington. He is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations in New York and the International Institute for Strategic Studies in London. His books include Fearful Symmetry, India and Pakistan Under the Shadow of Nuclear Weapons, India Since 1980, and his latest book just out is India, Pakistan and the Bomb, Debating Nuclear Stability in South Asia. Let's continue the discussion on the power crisis in India with someone who has been studying the power grid in India before the crash. And joining us now is Miriam Golden, the Vice Chair of Graduate Studies in the Department of Political Science at UCLA. And for the 2011-2012 academic year, she's been a visiting scholar at the Center for the Study of Democratic Politics at the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton University. And she's the author, with Brian Min, of Local Level Estimates of Corruption and Theft in the Energy Sector in Uttar Pradesh, India. She has just returned from India, where she's been studying the power grid in India's largest state and was there during the blackouts. Welcome to Background Briefing, Miriam Golden.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
So tell us about the work that you've been doing prior to this major crash of the grid. The fact that you were studying the grid in the first place, what did you know about it before the crash? And now everybody in the world seems to know that there's a problem. But I take it you were aware of problems before this crash.
Well, yes. There's a problem of energy supply in India. There isn't enough electricity for the whole country. And there are hundreds of thousands of villages that are still completely unelectrified, millions of people without electricity. And people who do have electricity find that they are subject to rolling blackouts all of the time because of just inadequate infrastructure in the country, which, of course, is hampering economic development by now, and is also a burden for everyone who lives there. So I was interested in how the country handles what is called load shedding, which are the rolling blackouts, and also why the country has ended up with such a particularly bad amount of loss in the power sector.
So, Miriam Golden, tell us about the extent to which the shortages are due, or the vulnerability of the grid, are due to theft. I mean, your study on Uttar Pradesh talked about corruption and theft in the energy sector. Walk us through that, if you will.
Well, we began that study because we thought that there had to be a lot of corruption in the energy sector. Since there is inadequate power, we thought that possibly firms were paying bribes to power corporation officials in order to get more favorable treatment and fewer blackouts, for instance. And so we began by trying to look at that, and we actually uncovered no evidence of systematic corruption in the power corporation in terms of their distribution of power. That doesn't mean that there isn't corruption, but we were not able to observe it in the data that we analyzed about the distribution of power and power losses. What we did see instead is that of all of the electricity that is sent out in the state of Uttar Pradesh, which is India's most populous state, one-third of it is never billed by the power corporation, which is a state provider of electricity. And it's not billed for because it's mainly going out to users who don't have meters, and they get electricity and they pay a flat rate for the electricity. And that is true of basically all of the rural population in the state, which is a very agricultural state. And the rural population mainly uses electricity to power the equipment that draws water from under the ground in order to irrigate their crops. So that large agricultural community is essentially getting power that is almost free. And that's a large part of why the power corporations in India are all virtually bankrupt and losing more money every day.
So what about the element of just people bootlegging into the grid? Is that pervasive?
Absolutely. There is a lot of that. There are many people who illegally tap into the power grid, in part often because they can't get a connection, for instance, or because they live in a slum residence where it's not possible to get a legal connection. So there is a lot of illegal tapping into the grid. That, of course, wouldn't cause the kind of blackout that India just experienced. And we have no way of estimating the scale of that kind of problem. We do know that if you want to predict something about when the power corporation in India is going to lose more money. It's going to lose more money in the period before an election. So we know that the power corporations in India are subject to political pressures, and that is a part of the problem that the politicians themselves could solve.
Well, the chief politician specifically in charge of power, Shinde, was promoted during this disaster, which is considered the worst blackout in global history. And he's been promoted to the Home Ministry. And he's basically said to the press that his performance was excellent.
Yeah.
What kind of a planet is this guy on?
Well, I would say that his performance was probably not excellent. And even worse than that is the fact that apparently a new minister for power is not being appointed, and it's simply going to fall under the responsibility of some other minister now, and that's really a problem, because the basic infrastructure in India, including power and other basic services, are very inadequate to an industrializing country, and need to have political resources devoted to them so that they can improve.
So what's your understanding of the future of power in India? Obviously, the notion of this emerging superpower has taken a bit of a hit, given the vulnerability to particularly the new high-tech arena that India is moving into. It all runs on electricity, and I understand that most businesses and big businesses have their own generating plants, and everybody has a backup generator. But in general, what is the wake-up call here in terms of new sources of power and I guess, you know, having a more... Because they still don't know what happened, do they?
They don't know what happened. And India does need additional power-generating capacity. So there is talk about trying to create more capacity in the system. Even if no more capacity is created, however, it needs substantially better management of the capacity it has. And that really means that the whole pricing system for electricity needs to be rethought. The price for electricity needs to increase so that the companies that provide it make enough money to then manage their equipment and maintain it properly, and potentially to expand the grid, since there are still so many people without any electricity in their homes at all in the country.
But surely, if you've got so much bootlegging going on, it's not surprising that they don't exactly know what the load is, do they? I mean, at least in a modern grid, you know exactly who's using it and how much is being used, and power gets diverted from areas where there's less use.
Well, they know how much power they're sending out at any time to every substation in the state, for instance, and they do know how much electricity they are able to bill for. So the losses in what they send out and what they bill for are the transmission and distribution losses. That is a third of the power in a state like Uttar Pradesh. And some of those losses do come from people tapping in illegally. As far as we can tell, more of those losses come from providing effectively free power to farmers. And a second order effect of providing almost free power to farmers is that because they use the power to draw water from under the ground, it means that effectively water is free. Water shouldn't be free because it's a very scarce resource. And the water table in much of India is falling because of overdrawing of groundwater. That will have absolutely catastrophic environmental and human consequences within the foreseeable future. And so it really is essential that the power supply be put on a more appropriate market footing, so that overdrawing of groundwater is lessened as well.
Again, I'm speaking with Miriam Golden, who's the Vice Chair of Graduate Studies in the Department of Political Science at UCLA, and she is just returned from India, where she's been studying the power grid in India's largest state, Uttar Pradesh. Now, that's a pretty alarming fact that you told us about the groundwater. You also mentioned earlier that the power companies lose money just before elections. So electricity
is... They lose more money just before elections. They always lose money, but they lose even more just before elections.
So that's pretty naked patronage, right?
Yeah, it means that the power corporation officials, who are essentially civil servants, are being leaned on by politicians to provide more electricity to electorally sensitive constituents and constituencies in the period just before elections. And in particular, farmers get more electricity just before elections, which they use, as I said, to power their irrigation equipment and then to overdraw on the groundwater. So it really is a situation that is, I think, not sustainable for many different reasons. And it will take a more powerful government or a more strong-willed government than currently seems to exist in India to begin to make the kinds of policy changes that are necessary.
Well, just in closing, Miriam Golden, I mean, India has celebrates its democracy, at least, you know, in China. If these kind of things happen, you just don't know about it, and nobody's accountable, and the Communist Party officials are above the law. At least India is a fairly transparent society and one that celebrates its democracy. But at the same time, it's a kind of paralyzed democracy, and it's highly the bureaucracy is kind of sclerotic. What kind of bold moves can be taken, and by whom?
Well, most elected officials in India get thrown out of office because they don't deliver improvements in public services to citizens, and so they lose office, and then they may get reelected after being out of office for a while, but they can't expect to remain in office as, for instance, politicians do in the United States. In the few cases that exist in India where a state chief minister, which is the equivalent of a governor, has really tried to improve public services, that person has experienced an increase in popular support. So political leadership really does matter, and I think that political leaders who are willing to take on the task of improving basic services for their citizens, and particularly for the poorest citizens, who are millions of people in India, are people who can get reelected. And that would be a big improvement for India, precisely because it is a democracy. It would be better if politicians wanted to stay in office longer in that country.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Miriam Golden.
Thank you very much for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Miriam Golden, who's the Vice Chair of Graduate Studies at the Department of Political Science at UCLA. And during the 2011-2012 academic year, she has been a visiting scholar at the Center for the Study of Democratic Politics at the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton University. And she's the author, with Brian Min, of Local Level Estimates of Corruption and Theft in the Energy Sector in Uttar Pradesh, India. She has just returned from India, where she's been studying the power grid in India's largest state, and was there during the blackouts. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment talking about how the Tea Party captured Texas.
Sit down, man.
Glenn Beck.
Sit down, man.
Rand Paul.
Sit down, man.
LL Cool J.
Sit down, man.
Netanyahu.
Sit down, man.
Sarah Palin.
Sit down, man.
Newt Gingrich.
Sit down, man.
Toby Keith.
Sit down, man.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Matt Angell, who directs the Texas Democratic Trust and the Lone Star Project, a political action committee that aims to be an aggressive fact checker on the Republican Party, both at the state and national levels. Matt Angell has served as executive director of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, and from 2000 to 2004, he was executive director of the House Democratic Caucus. Welcome to Background Briefing, Matt Angell.
Happy to be here, Ian. How are you?
Pretty good. And I guess if you're a Tea Party supporter, you got to be happy with what happened down in Texas. It's pretty hard to believe that the lieutenant governor, who was, of course, supported by the governor, Rick Perry, is not considered conservative enough, and that an insurgent Tea Party candidate won, Ted Cruz.
It really is interesting that in Texas, the Republican Party has turned the page on extremists like Rick Perry and gone even more extreme. In Texas now, with this Tea Party win, the most extreme elements in our society are in control of the Republican Party in Texas.
Well, it's even worse, though, isn't it, when you compare it to the senator who's being replaced, Senator Kay Bailey Hutchison. Didn't she have a reputation for being pretty sensible?
Yes, she was one of the last of the Texas Republican centrists. She's somebody that, while she was conservative, she was somebody who was reasonable, particularly on things like women's health and children's health and on responsible environmental issues. With Ted Cruz, you've got somebody who is really going to be a torch carrier for the most extreme elements, the types of people who want to cut further into children's health care and cut further into women's health and even do more damage to our environment.
So this will mean, and of course, Jim DeMint and Rand Paul in the Senate supported him and stumped for him, and the sort of lexicon of Tea Party media stars, Sarah Palin and a lot of the Fox broadcasters were down, and Sean Hannity and others were very much in his corner. What's this going to mean in terms of Texas politics or the representation of Texas in the United States Senate? Because my understanding about the Tea Party members of both the House and the Senate is it's essentially a protest movement. It's all about sort of self-righteous right-wing rhetoric, but not about getting anything done.
Well, that's exactly right. They celebrate gridlock and see that as their mission, to make sure nothing happens. They are really a polar opposite of the realizing the aspirations of most Americans, and that it's Congress works together and gets some things constructive done. Their mission is to muck up the works and make sure that nothing gets done. And the real danger with Ted Cruz is that he's somebody who actually is very shrewd, brings quite a lot of intellectual firepower to the effort to make sure nothing gets done. And it is worries me because while he's a new recruit to the crazy caucus in the U.S. Senate, he's somebody that will bring some strategic strategic thought to their efforts.
So what explains then the enormous amount of money that was spent? And I'd be interested to know where Cruz got his money from. I can understand where Dewhurst got his money because he's the kind of establishment candidate. But clearly Cruz got a lot of money, didn't he?
Absolutely. What you had were national Tea Party interests. You had Dick Armey's super PAC came in and spent an enormous amount of money. And so a lot of Cruz's money came from outside of the state of Texas. David Dewhurst himself is a multimillionaire. And so he self-financed a lot of his campaign as well as raised money from some in-state rich Republicans. But Ted Cruz was, to a great degree, funded outside of the state of Texas.
Well, the Club for Growth, Grover Norquist, they spent, $5 million to defeat Dewhurst. Why? What was their objection?
Absolutely. You had Dick Armey, you had Grover Norquist, you had the Koch brothers, you had all of the bad actors in terms of really dismantling the social infrastructure of our country were playing big time in Texas on behalf of Ted Cruz.
Again, I'm speaking with Matt Engel, who directs the Texas Democratic Trust and the Lone Star Project, a political action committee that aims to be an aggressive fact checker on the Republican Party, both at the state and national levels. Now, what does this say about the Democrats? Is it all over? I mean, this is the state that brought us President Johnson. I'm trying to think of who was the guy that ran for vice president.
You had Ann Richards and Lyndon Johnson, and you've had Ralph Yarborough, and some of the real progressive heroes really had their base in Texas.
Lloyd Benson.
It is disappointing that the last 20 years Texas has produced really some of the most destructive elements in politics from the Republican side. But I remain hopeful in Texas because by turning to such an extreme element within their party, Republicans are really pushing out fair-minded people who might think of themselves as conservative, but they do believe in good schools, they do believe in health care for children. And whereas those people didn't want to give Democrats a chance in recent years, I think now they're going to look to Democrats as an alternative. And interestingly, the Democrats have nominated a very, very capable and responsible candidate in Paul Sadler for the U.S. Senate. In fact, he is probably the most qualified and capable Senate candidate that Democrats have nominated since Lloyd Benson served in the U.S. Senate. And with a little bit of financial backing and with a little bit of political good fortune, I think Sadler can get his story out. It would be a very, very hard race for him, but I think he can start to establish for a lot of mainstream Texans that the Republican Party has left them behind and that they can look to the Democrats for a more responsible alternative.
Well, how would the Latino vote factor in this if the Democrat has a chance? Obviously, with Ted Cruz being the son of a Cuban immigrant, the Republicans probably feel that they've got somebody that can reach out to the Latino community. That's the fastest growing political demographic in the country and in particular in the state of Texas. So give us a sense of the Latino factor in Texas politics and whether Cruz is going to peel off some votes.
He won't at all, to tell you the truth, Ian. That's really kind of a Republican talking point, but it really doesn't go anywhere. Ted Cruz, while he is a Latino, he didn't get any votes from Latinos. Very few Hispanics participated in the Republican Party. They weren't part of Cruz's base. In fact, most people in the Republican Party in Texas probably thought he was Ted Cruz along the lines of Tom Cruise rather than as a Latino. While Republicans like to pay lip service to reaching out to Hispanic voters in Texas, they don't really do it, and they don't count on Hispanic voters. Hispanics in Texas vote reliably Democratic. The only Republican that really tried, with any sincerity, to try to get Hispanic votes was George W. Bush. And once he became president, he pretty much abandoned that effort. The current Republican establishment in Texas, particularly the Tea Party, they're very hostile to Latinos, including Ted Cruz. And so I don't think he's a threat to peel off the Hispanic vote. We just have a challenge as Democrats in Texas to build the real coalition you need between Hispanics, African Americans, and progressive Anglos and get it funded and get them working together in order to win a statewide race.
And you also said that you may be able to peel off some centrists who find the Tea Party too hard to swallow. So, Matt Engel, I thank you for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Matt Engel, who directs the Texas Democratic Trust and the Lone Star Project, a political action committee that aims to be an aggressive fact checker on the Republican Party, both at the state and national levels. Matt Engel has served as executive director of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, and from 2000 to 2004, he was the executive director of the House Democratic Caucus. We're going to take a brief station break and be back sharing some memories of Gore Vidal, who passed away yesterday here in Los Angeles at the age of 86.
And all of his joy when he laughed, it suffered all of his joy when he cried, and Sometimes when he got into talking, man, he could rattle on and on. He was a good man and now he's gone.
And maybe the song which could be a theme for the whole world. I'm gonna lay down my sword and shield down by the riverside, down by the riverside, down by the riverside. I'm gonna lay down my sword and shield down by the riverside.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters and this is Background Briefing. And I was privileged to spend a little time with Gore Vidal, particularly during the 2000 and 2004 elections. I was a straight man to Gore Vidal at a lot of political house parties and fundraisers. It wasn't as if Gore was thrilled with his hapless cousin Al Gore or John Kerry. But as an historian, he was appalled by George W. Bush, who history will surely judge as perhaps the worst and most destructive president of the United States. It was so obvious that Gore loved politics and talking politics. Of course, he did this all for free. His only stipulation was a tall glass of good scotch. Let's play some clips from the Pacifica archive, starting in 1994. A conversation with Jessica Mitford, of course, Jessica Mitford from the famous or infamous British aristocratic family, the Mitfords, speaking with Gore Vidal in 1994.
Now, this is a tough one. Based on your careful study of human history, how might the rise of fundamentalism in the world play out?
Well, fundamentalism is a sign of a breakdown in the economy of a state. It's wherever there's great poverty and you cannot look to the rulers for money, for succor, for anything, you will get God in one form or another. I have always thought that a great disaster that befell the West was monotheism. We were doing very well before then in the Greco-Roman world and older civilizations. We're about to see, you young ones here will see it, I shan't, but I see the beginnings of it, the rise of China. Well, there you have a society that's 3,000 years older than we are. It's Confucian, and Confucius is an atheistic system of thought and of education. Rather better, I would have thought, for a people as mixed as Americans than these demented churches that we have. But our churches would have been a lot less demented if we had not exempted them from taxation. I knew a science fiction writer years ago when I was first starting out as a writer, most unattractive person I think I've ever met. And that is the god, L. Ron Hubbard. And you can't tax them. These Justice Department just found that they were a genuine religion. So we have yet another force in our lives which could be undone by taxation. But the rise of fundamentalism in the world, I think, has to do with really entropy. We're running out of everything. The next millennium will really be a struggle for water. It'll be who has control over the two ice caps and is getting water down, and there are going to be terrible wars over water. Now that's a serious subject, unlike monotheism.
Now here's a very good one. With April 15th approaching, would you condone non-payment of income taxes as a legitimate form of dissent? If so, how?
Huh? Well, we tried that at the time of the Vietnam War. I was co-chairman of something called the People's Party with Dr. Spock, and they will put you in jail. I think that if it were done on a sufficiently large scale, you could probably bring the government to its knees, but that takes organization. There's something, what is optimistic in what is rather a dark horizon, has been the rise of computers, cassettes, instant communication is now possible. So you could really organize a million people in a day or two. Whereas before you had to mail letters, you'd have to wait, you'd have to do this, do that. There are a lot of things that can really happen suddenly. If you say to the government, if you don't cut 30% out of what you're now spending on military procurement, we won't pay 30% of our tax. They can't put 10 million people in jail. They will try. Have you heard the latest that the army camps, now that they are dumping the military personnel back into the civilian population, the generals knowing that the politicians will be blamed for this, they're now talking about using the military camps for drug offenders. So tax offenders might end up there as well. But I think it is a good ploy, but it has to be done on a large scale. I not only pay American taxes, I think I paid for the stealth bomber that year. .38%, thank you.
And that was Gore Vidal speaking in discussion with Jessica Mitford in 1994. And Gore Vidal, of course, was a World War II veteran, a member of the Greatest Generation. I remember we were speaking together at an event at the time of Israel's war with Hezbollah, and he was telling me his war stories from the Aleutian Islands in World War II. He was obviously proud of his service, and of course, he did serve in the war for the United States. People like John Wayne and Ronald Reagan, of course, are the icons of patriotism, but it's worth noting that Gore Vidal was a veteran. Here he is in 2002 talking about his military service.
I put together a few notes of some things that we might talk about, think about, might explain the predicament that the country is in. Very wise people have seen it coming. I'm not one of them, but there were others along the way. I'd like to start by saying that one of the places I come from, I belong to a minority that is one of the smallest in the United States, and with every day it grows smaller. I am a veteran of World War II, and I can recall thinking when I got out of the Army in 1946, well, that's that. We won. And those who come after us will never need to do this again. Then came the two mad wars of imperial vanity, Korea and Vietnam. They were bitter for us, not to mention for the so-called enemy. Next, we were enrolled in a perpetual war against what seemed like the enemy of the month club. Remember Noriega? All the drugs in the world went through that man, and Bush Sr. went down, killed a lot of Panamanians, arrested him, put him on trial in the United States, which had no jurisdiction, and locked him up for life. We still don't know quite why, and the drugs are flowing with the same ease as they did before. Gaddafi, remember him? We killed him. We did it to kill his daughter. And somehow his eyeliner had offended us. I mean, we pick our enemies shrewdly. This perpetual war kept major revenues going to military procurement, secret police, and the bribing of warlords, while withholding money from us, the taxpayers, with our petty concerns for life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But no matter how corrupt our system became over the last century, and I lived through three quarters of it, we still held on to the Constitution and, above all, to the Bill of Rights. I have been discouraged at times, like all of you, but I always felt that the Republic was upon a firm foundation and that no one could seriously undermine it. I never once believed that I would ever see a day like this one, when a great part of the nation, forget the polls, it is a great part of the nation, of we, the people, should be opposed to an arbitrary and secret government preparing wars for us to fight in. Sensibly, they leave the fighting to us. During Vietnam, Bush fled to the Texas Air Force. Cheney, when asked why he had avoided service in Vietnam, replied, "I had other priorities." Well, so did 13 million of us 60 years ago. Priorities that many were never able to fulfill.
And that is Gore Vidal speaking in 2002. And let's now go to another clip of Gore Vidal. This is on the eve of the Iraq War in 2004 at a peace rally in Los Angeles.
How did human events bring us here today and all across the country? We can certainly blame the oil and gas hustlers who have hijacked the government from presidency to Congress to, most ominously, the judiciary. It was Benjamin Franklin, that nice, witty, plump gentleman, who saw our future most clearly back in 1787, when he was a delegate to the Constitutional Convention at Philadelphia. He was old. He was dying. He was not well enough to speak, but he had prepared a text which a friend read. It is so dark a statement that most school histories omit his key words. Benjamin Franklin urged the convention to accept the Constitution despite all its faults. It might, he said, provide good government in the short term and may be a blessing to the people if well administered. And I believe he said that this is likely to be well administered for a course of years and only end in despotism, as other forms have done before it, when the people have so become corrupted as to need despotic government, being incapable of any other. Franklin's prophecy came true in December 2000. When the Supreme Court bulldozed its way through the Constitution in order to select as their president the loser in the presidential election of that year. Despotism is now securely in the saddle. The old republic is a shadow of itself, and we now stand in the glare of a nuclear world empire with a government that sees as its true enemy, we the people, deprived of our electoral franchise. (Laughter) War is the usual aim of despots, and war is what we are going to get, unless with help from well-worshippers in new old Europe and from ourselves awake at last. We must persuade this peculiar administration that they are acting entirely on their own and against all of our common history. The other night on CNN, I brought the admirable Aaron Brown to a full stop. Not with Benjamin Franklin. I feel the history lesson coming on. But with President John Quincy Adams, who said in the 1820s, on the subject of our fighting to liberate Greece from Turkey, he said, "The United States goes not abroad in search of monsters to destroy. If the United States took up all foreign affairs, she might become the dictatress of the world. But she would no longer be the ruler of her own spirit." So let us regain our lost spirit, and should we be allowed in the year 2004 to hold a presidential election here in the homeland, we shall realize that the only regime change that need concern our regained spirit or soul is in Washington.
And I'm afraid that that's all the time we have for the clip of Gore Vidal speaking in 2004 at a Los Angeles peace rally on the eve of the Iraq War. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Brooke Peterson. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Quiet voice, singing something to me. An angel song about the home of the brave and this land here under the free. One time, one night. Standing along the side of the pickup truck, a shot rang out in the night, just when everything seemed right. Another headline written down in America. The guy that lived next door in 305 took the kids to the park and disappeared.